855. Pikes Peak Suicide Prevention Center has support groups for people who've attempted suicide or those who may have been left behind by those who have died by suicide. They're on Facebook, or you can reach them on their website, or by calling 719-573-7447. There's a national suicide prevention helpline and website. You can talk to someone at 1-800-273-TALK. Or if you want to talk to someone like Brad Duncan at Talk Life, that peer support group for mental health, you can just type www.talklife.co. There's an app you can download, and people just like you can talk to. The song you've been listening to was written and performed by Riley's friend, Lily Yoakum. This episode of What Were You Thinking was reported by me, Dina Temple-Raston, and Caitlin Pierce, who also produced this episode. Our editor is Martha Little, sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ancrum. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. And one little postscript. We heard from medical examiner Leon Kelly at the end of the summer of 2017. There hadn't been any more suicides since our visit. He's hoping that holds true for the rest of the year. This is Audible. In our next episode, if you spend all your spare time on your smartphone or playing internet games, are you really addicted?
Ask me 7 months ago, 6 months ago, who am I? What about you? I'm a gamer. I like games. Taking that away from me, you know, made me feel kind of lost. I was like, well, who am I?
That's next time on What Were You Thinking?
Hello. So, it's about, well, it is 9:36, and I'm going to get a cold shower after this.
That's Felix Graham, and a couple of months ago, we sent him a tape recorder with some instructions.
Okay, accidentally pressed the stop button, which was not the smartest move I've ever made.
And we asked if he could help us capture something we've never really heard before, the private thoughts of a 13-year-old weaning himself off internet games.
Well, I really got into gaming when my dad was, I'll explain some of the time, but I'll just put it simply, when he left, I felt a bit sorry for myself. My outlook on life a few months ago was, who cares, no one else matters, world's going to hell. I tricked myself into believing I was depressed because I felt sorry for myself.
So he'd come home from school, go up to his room, and then strap himself in for another gaming session that usually would go until the small hours of the morning.
I stand up from my seat, I'm a little stiff, my eyes are going, my head's racing, I can see the crumbs from food I've eaten there. Stand up, I take my headset off. Then you go to bed and you think, I hate myself.
But as you'll see, there's nothing hateful about Felix Graham. Just the opposite.
Ask me 7 months ago, 6 months ago, who am I? What about you? I'm a gamer. I like games. These are the games I like. Taking that away from me made me feel kind of lost. I was like, well, who am I?
He remembers the day he decided to change everything.
2nd of January. So I've been playing for 10 hours straight, 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. On that day, after playing for so long and making no progress, as in, that day could have just not happened, I realised, you know. And I think at that moment I kind of realised that it wasn't the solution to my problems, it was the cause of them.
Are kids like Felix just obsessed in that way teenagers can be about things? Or is this more serious? Is this an addiction?
And this is the worst thing about it, is that when you quit, you're like, yeah, I've quit, but now what?
I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and this is What Were You Thinking? A show about young people, their decisions, and how their adolescent brains may be driving them to do things that are pretty hard for the rest of us to understand. In this episode, we'll not only visit Felix, our gamer in England, but we'll also travel to Korea, where esports are an obsession, and the government has taken steps to tear kids away from their screens.
So these are the division between the children who are just enjoying the game and the children who are actually having problem with those games.
And he was just didn't engage, didn't want to interact, didn't want to go out. Literally went from somebody who would quite happily go out for a walk, didn't want to do that.
Adolescence and internet addiction on this episode. So here's an amazing fact. 9 out of 10 Americans who meet the medical criteria for addiction started smoking, drinking, or using other drugs before the age of 18. Kids are at risk of addiction for lots of reasons, but one of them has to do specifically with their brains and how they're developing between the ages of 13 to 24, and it's something called neuroplasticity. MIT neuroscientist Anne Grabiel says the same thing that makes their brains absorb and imprint information incredibly quickly is what makes them so susceptible to addiction.
And neuroplasticity is something that fundamentally we ought to be able to work with. That, at least, is malleable.
It can be changed both ways.
Yes, ma'am.
So it might be changed for the bad,
That's
but it
right.
might be able to be changed for the good as well.
That's right. And these networks, which are so plastic, are themselves still developing.
So what if you could find a way to tinker with plasticity and convince young people to stop negative behaviors for good? That's exactly what some researchers are trying to do. Take advantage of that plasticity, which they think might actually make it easier for adolescents like Felix Graham in England to unlearn bad habits. When we met Felix Graham, he had been game-free for 95 days.
It's going to be 100 days coming near to my birthday as well.
He lives in the north of England with his 16-year-old brother Oscar and their mom, Chris Pearson. They live in Durham County, about 2 miles from a 14th-century castle that, among other things, claims to be haunted. Their house, not haunted, is a cream-colored stucco building at the end of a quiet street.
Yeah, I'm Felix.
Hi, Felix. Hello. Dina, nice to meet you.
We found Felix after we posted a message online saying we were looking for someone who considered themselves addicted to internet games. Felix responded by saying that he was, past tense, and he helpfully added that he could give us a teenager's perspective. After asking his mom if it was okay to visit him, we showed up on their doorstep.
Have a seat.
Okay. Felix, you want to take coat?
The two brothers are redheads.
Are you considered ginger?
Wait, do you know strawberry blonde?
No, that's not a real color.
Oscar is reserved and seems amused by his younger brother. There's almost a hum of happy, boyish energy that comes from Felix. He looks like the British singer Ed Sheeran with a round, friendly face.
That's all I get called? Ah, that's fun.
Felix and his brother share the top floor of the house.
The key to getting up is 3 steps of time.
Felix's room is small and neat.
This is the infamous desk where the gaming used to happen. But now it's like not so gaming, it's more studying and...
But you literally changed the entire environment, didn't you? So it's so different.
The bed was like this way, and the desk was next to it. So it's like, oh, I'm playing games and now I'm in bed. So it was like an easy transition, if you know what I mean. It didn't really... And that's how it was quite easy, because I used to have a massive desk with a huge TV, and it was like heaven, well, at the time.
Then his mother, Chris, giggles and motions towards the other room.
Do you know what I'm laughing about?
He's gaming.
He is Oscar, and we peer in to see that he's batting away at his computer keyboard, playing a very popular shooting game called Overwatch. He minimizes his screen when we come in, and then insists that I meet his live pet lizard, Fat Tony.
I'm gonna have to get him out, Anna. Oh, yeah.
Fat Tony lives under a hollowed-out log in a terrarium in the corner of Oscar's bedroom.
You are the fattest, laziest lizard ever.
Oh, my God.
Okay, no, he doesn't need to get any
closer. No, honestly, he doesn't feel how you're going to regret it if you don't touch him.
He feels like rubbery. On the top.
And yeah, just give it a little...
And on his tummy underneath.
So, full disclosure here, I'm not a lizard person. I give the reptile a quick touch.
Wow, what kind of lizard is he?
Bearded dragon.
Of course he is.
And for a moment, while I was petting a lizard I really didn't like, I forgot why we'd come. Gaming seemed the furthest thing from everyone's mind.
I think for both of them, I think they would agree, is when they were both when Oscar was heavily playing, he was much more withdrawn, weren't you?
Oscar smiles and nods.
He was kind of up in his room. Felix went through the same thing, up in his room, much more isolated, didn't interact downstairs at all. But their language was vile and the aggression level was quite tangible because I can hear the thumping and the banging and the screaming and the shouting. Oscar was particularly bad at that in terms of quite... being physically demonstrative and would be banging on a desk and screaming and shouting at these people who were have no idea where they were in the world. But Felix, it was language. The language, his language really changed, and it was not pleasant at all. And he was just didn't engage and want to interact, didn't want to go out. Literally went from somebody who would quite happily go out for a walk, didn't want to do that.
And had you figured out what it was, or did it take some time to figure out that that's what was behind it, as opposed to just being a regular teenager?
Talking to other parents, they were going through a similar experience. And it was, it started to be where this can't just be a coincidence.
Just so I can understand, are you a gamer?
I am.
So meet Yvette Wan. Do you have a favorite game?
I do. These days I'm playing Overwatch.
That's the same game we caught Oscar playing.
Overwatch is a team-based shooting game.
Professor Wan is an assistant professor at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and she specializes in human-computer interaction, which basically means she studies people like Felix and Oscar. And she says there's a lot of disagreement over whether internet gaming should be officially classified as an addiction.
In my research, I define addiction as a lack of self-regulation, which means you are unable to stop yourself from either starting to play the game or stop yourself from finishing the game. To some extent, I think that regardless of what the clinical definition is, if you think you have a problem, then it's a problem.
So do you think that gaming or technology addiction is actually real?
I do think it's real, but I don't think it's as prevalent as it is made out to be.
If you use brain science to try to understand why adolescents are so obsessed with internet games, you may have assumed, as I did, that this was all about dopamine, that neurotransmitter in the brain that gives you a rush. As it turns out, dopamine is involved, but only tangentially. If you put a kid into an MRI machine and have him start working the buttons on a gaming console, dopamine does start stimulating the limbic system, which plays a role in motivation and emotion and learning. That makes sense. But there's another key area of the brain that's on fire as well. Structures right under the wrinkly outer rind of the brain that are known as the basal ganglia.
Basal ganglia are systems related to getting out some form of action, either mental action or physical action.
Dr. Grabiel's specialty at MIT is the study of the basal ganglia.
And what's so fascinating is that these networks of neurons in the forebrain that are related to emotion or mood control, they get into the basal ganglia and then they do affect action, either mental action or movement.
So researchers believe the basal ganglia is an integral part of internet gaming disorders because it's sending messages to other parts of the brain with very black and white instructions. Either do it or don't do it. Do it more or do it less.
So there are different do it and don't do it systems. It's like it's a whole committee of do it systems and committee of don't do it. And these different committee members have different voices. And they are slightly differently modulated by things like neurotransmitters like dopamine. So you can imagine that in the end it's a committee decision that would lead to something like a repetitive behavior.
She says drug addiction is different because drugs actually hijack the do-it system and take control of it.
But in the case of like internet gaming, you can't say it's a drug that's doing it. Something has engraved a new loop into this whole circuit.
Grabiel says engraving a new loop into the brain circuitry suggests an obsessive compulsive disorder, not an addiction. And that means in most cases, the cure is usually a little behavioral therapy, changing habits so pathways in the brain circuitry are changed too.
It should be possible to retrain the system to get de-addicted to gaming or de-OCD-like in gaming. And I think that in the field of OCD, clinical field of OCD, I am on the side that behavioral therapy is a very wonderful adjunct to other pharmacologic and other treatments.
South Korea has been struggling with internet gaming problems for years. So there's a famous story about this that I'd always thought was apocryphal. As it turns out, it actually happened back in 2009.
In South Korea today, a mother and father are accused of starving their newborn daughter to death.
Two admitted leaving their premature infant, sarang, or love in English, at home so they could play this popular online game.
Mr. Kim said, I think of our baby in heaven. I will be guilty until the day I die.
Their lawyer argued the two are addicted to online gaming.
The case was a wake-up call for Korea. How Koreans got here is a story filled with the best intentions. Back in the 1990s, the government began investing in high-speed internet to usher Korea into the modern age. Just 10 years later, nearly half the population had high-speed broadband. And when they say high-speed, they mean lightning fast.
Just to give you a comparison of the speed of internet in 1998 in South Korea, it was faster than the top speed that you can get for high-speed internet in the U.S. now.
That kind of internet speed not only makes it easier to send email and download movies, it also makes it easier to play internet games because you don't have to wait for buffering. And that partly explains why an entire generation in Korea seems to be playing internet games. But there's another reason that's just as compelling. Korean culture.
A teen's life in Korea is nothing like a teen's life here in the U.S.
Professor Yvette Wan grew up in Korea, and she knows firsthand how stressful it is.
I remember myself when I was a teenager, I would go to high school at 8 in the morning and come home 10 at night and still have to do things when I get home. The really interesting thing is that because of all of this emphasis on school, that kind of creates the somewhat rebellious or escapism for students who want to kind of get away from all of that. And I think that exacerbates the situation.
This stop is Yongsan. In Korea, the way kids escape from all that schoolwork is by sneaking off to something called a PC bong.
That is the PC bong.
Okay, so we've arrived.
The PC bong is the perfect laboratory for anyone trying to understand Korea's obsession with internet gaming. It's a 24-hour internet gaming cafe, and you see signs for them everywhere in Seoul. And our guide to the PC bong is this guy.
My name is Song Yeol-i in Korean name, and I'm 22 years old in American age, and I'm majoring in English education.
He told us to call him Yeol. Until recently, Yeol played a game called League of Legends.
And when you were doing it a lot, how much a week?
12 hours in a day. 8, play game, 8, eat, play game.
And he'd come to the PC bong to get his fix.
Going into an office building, yeah?
So the PC bong Yeol took me to was like most of them, down a sketchy set of stairs into the basement of an office building. But once you get in, the place was nicer than I expected. It looks a lot like someone's finished basement. Nice carpet, halogen lights. But instead of a monster TV, there are rows of what look like study carrels, each set up with a computer and a big comfortable chair that looks like it was taken from the Starship Enterprise. There are no windows, but someone has helpfully painted a blue sky with fluffy clouds on the back wall. Yeol and I are here so he can teach me how to play League of Legends.
Then you need to play with an AI.
Oh, someone will play me and kill me. Yeah. The computer will
computer
play me.
Computer will kill you.
That sounds great.
PC bongs used to be about internet games and computers, a place where you could sneak away to play games without your parents finding out. But they've expanded the business model.
Oh, Jill, are you hungry?
I want some drink.
You want some drink, so show me how to work.
Yeol orders an oksuksu cha, a traditional Korean tea made from boiled corn kernels. It tastes like liquid popcorn.
Beginner, and expert, and
let's go with beginner so I stay alive okay. For just a minute.
That's one of the characters from League of Legends singing. She looks like a little Red Riding Hood with a teddy bear.
Like, please hide, I will find you, like that.
We play for half an hour. I'm terrible at it. So Yeol eventually is sitting in the Starship Enterprise chair in front of the screen, tapping away. I wonder as he plays whether he would let his kids play internet games. Yeol, it turns out, is very progressive about this.
Yes, I will. Because they need the time. to play.
Will you play with your children?
If they want.
Oh, okay.
If they didn't want to play with Papa, so then I'm not playing with them.
Maybe they don't know that Papa's a diamond level.
Maybe. Someday they will know.
So what is it in the adolescent brain that might be compelling young people like Yol and Felix to play internet games for hours? Korean researchers may have a head start in piecing that together. They say it has to do with the brain's natural development. Any parent knows that colors and shapes are enough stimulation to keep babies and toddlers happy. Adolescents, which scientists define as people between the ages of 13 and 24, crave a different kind of stimulation, something that combines concentration with strategy, which, no surprise here, sounds exactly like an internet game. And in Korea, there's a social component, too. Internet games aren't just something you play in your room. It comes packaged as a spectacle, with crowds and professional players and huge cash prizes. Internet game enthusiasts fill whole stadiums or downtown arenas to watch their favorite teams play. It's like the NFL, but without the turf. And in case you think this is a crazy Korean thing, it isn't. Las Vegas has its own esports team, and the casinos there are trying to figure out how they can get a piece of this internet gaming action. But ground zero for esports is still in South Korea.
So, I'm inside Champions Korea, and it kind of feels like a nightclub. There are giant screens in the front, and dance lights, loud music, and two sets of what they call casters.
See, you might just be going for a steal. Here it comes.
Rob's Tigers are closing in.
Steal there from Mighty Bear. Of course, because of that ward.
They're taking off their headsets and giving each other high fives. A little Gatorade for one of them.
We make friends with one of the guys sitting next to us in the gold seats in the second row. His English name is Luke.
Do you play League of Legends?
Yeah, I play myself.
How much do you play?
I'm currently at Diamond 5 tier.
That means his score is in the top 2% of League of Legends players. Though when he explained it to me, he did seem a tiny bit disappointed that I didn't already know that that was a pretty big deal.
And how much do you play, like, a day or a week?
In the weekdays, I have to go to work, so the weekends, I usually play about 8 to 10 hours a day.
Really? 8 to 10 hours a day? No wonder everyone is talking about this in terms of addiction. But Luke tells us he thinks that in Korea, this is about something else. It's about the nation coming to terms with prosperity and the generation gap that has created.
So our parents' generation really don't know the fun of playing online games, and they can't understand it. And Korea had a hard time in the 60s, 70s. So there are different priorities between generations right now. So people in my generation do believe that a proper amount of leisure is really fine for you. But my parents and my friends' parents, all of them think that playing games are inappropriate.
Was seen as so inappropriate that about 10 years ago, Korean parents demanded that the federal government do something about this obsession with smartphones and computers. In Seoul, local politicians responded by putting together two surveys. One focused on smartphone use and the other on the internet. Students are required to fill it out now every year. Here are some of the questions read by an interpreter.
Question number one, because of the overusing of smartphone, my school score has fallen down. And number two, because of the usage of smartphone, it is difficult for me to do the things that I planned. For example, studying or going to the academy. Number three.
The second survey is about internet use.
Number one, Because of internet usage, I think my health is worse. My headache is getting worse. Number three, I haven't done the plans that I was supposed to do. I try to deceive the usage time of number five. Because of internet usage, I'm spending much more money. I try to reduce the time of using internet, but I have failed already. And number 10, after I stop using internet, I want to do it again.
The latest figures tallied from these surveys for 2017 suggest that about 9% of Korean students in elementary, middle, and high school are compulsively playing internet games. And about 14% are spending too much time on their smartphones. Kids who get the higher scores in these surveys are referred to counseling at a place called the I Will Center. There are several I Will centers around the country now, and the one we visit is in a college about 20 minutes from downtown Seoul. And when you walk in, it looks like a cross between a doctor's office and a youth rec center.
Hello.
We meet a woman there named Dr. Young Sung Wan. She's a senior staff member.
My name is Young Sung Wan.
The counseling process here usually starts after those surveys we talked about are collated and tallied. That's when parents and teachers begin to worry about a child's results.
Do kids tend to come in here voluntarily? Or do their parents bring them in kicking and screaming?
Most of the adolescent children or other teenagers in Korea, they don't come here voluntarily because most of teenagers are using much of their time and spending much of their time playing games. So they think, oh, maybe I'm just one of those a little more playing ones. And they don't think that it's a problem for them. So they don't come here voluntarily.
She says there is a group counseling being held right now upstairs, so we can't go in, but we can look at it from outside.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the group counseling for the prevention of internet gambling. And the children are right now playing the games, and these kinds of activities could prevent them from addictions to gambling or internet gambling. So
I peek inside to see six young women playing the card game Uno and giggling. This is about more than just too much screen time. Some kids are actually getting into debt by spending money on the games. They're falling behind in school. There are problems at home. These are all things that can be addressed, at least in part, by counseling and cognitive behavioral therapy.
So we're not using the word addiction a lot, but we're trying to use words like over-obsessed or something like that, so that we could use or classify these children as the ones who are having problem in their daily lives. So these are the division between the children who are just enjoying the game and the children who are actually having problem with those games. Yeah.
So you're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder, is that right? Obsession?
강박장애를 말하는 거냐? 근데 강박 obsessed는 아니고 over dependent, too dependent.
Dr. Hee Sung Kim is the director of the I Will Center and a professor at Myeongji College. She says, as worried as the government is about internet games, the actual cases of full-fledged addiction are quite rare.
정말 게임을 너무 컨트롤이 안 돼.
Game addiction. Actually, the actual number of game-addicted children who are having a serious disorder of controlling their wills are very small number.
The I Will Center is trying to prevent that number from rising. They see kids several times a week for weeks at a time. But if therapy doesn't work, if counseling doesn't seem to be reworking those pathways in the brain,
in that case, then we try to send them to hospitals.
One of the hospitals they are sent to is this one. Chung-An University Hospital. There's a huge atrium in the lobby, and it's teeming with people. The patients are in pajamas, and their families in street clothes are hovering near them. We're the only non-Koreans in the place, so the man we're meeting finds us right away.
I don't know who you are. How did you find us?
All of our Korean?
Yeah.
Dr. Doug Hyun-han specializes in addiction here. He focused on addiction in the brain during a postdoc at Harvard, and as part of that research has compared the brain scans of people who are addicted to gambling to those who have played lots of games on the internet. He thinks that obsessed internet gamers have lost the ability to control themselves. For most of us, little rituals of behavior provide structure. I need a cup of coffee in the morning before I can come up with pleasantries. Structure. Han is interested in what happens beyond that, when those habits threaten to destroy the life of a patient.
compared to the alcohol.
Alcohol and drug addictions are linked to mood disorders like depression or mania. We've seen internet gaming linked to attention issues.
The reason that's good news is because if excessive internet gaming is indeed a behavior, it probably doesn't need a drug-based solution, but instead can be remedied by something less draconian, something like cognitive behavioral therapy, which takes advantage of that adolescent neuroplasticity from the ages of 13 to 24. As a general matter, the brain usually processes things in a very straightforward way. It sees something, commits it to short-term memory, and then does something in response. Han believes people with internet gaming disorders don't go through all those steps. They see something and commit something to memory, but they don't have a goal. They don't finish the action. That's what people with obsessive compulsive disorders do.
So can we say without any doubt that internet gaming and the internet is not an addiction, but it's a, is it a behavioral compulsion? Is it a behavioral issue?
Yeah. I think the internet addiction is not...
I don't think internet addiction is an addiction at all. Internet gaming disorder or internet addictions should be classified as impulse control disorders.
So, now that we have the diagnosis, what's the cure? How do you get the attention of someone who appears to be obsessed with technology? If you ask Dr. Han, the prescription is more technology, or more specifically, virtual reality. Han has designed a special virtual reality game that he says actually helps the brain rewire itself. Yep, that's the music from it. And the name is equally as silly.
I made the name. This is the iguana.
This is iguana, which stands for Internet Gaming Use Assessment and Aid. And there's a big animated iguana on the first screen.
Is the reason why VR therapy works because the brain can't tell the difference between virtual reality and reality?
Yeah, right.
He uses the iWill Center's behavioral therapy with a technology twist. Studying brain scans of young people with internet gaming disorders, Dr. Han has found that their frontal cortex, the part that makes the decisions, is disengaging from the limbic system, the part of the brain that reinforces behavior. Dr. Han thinks that's why adolescents play hours of internet games without any guilt.
When you felt the guilty or the depressed mood, the limbic system...
When you feel guilty or depressed, that's in part the limbic system at work.
And in this case, that's a good thing, because that pang of guilt can reinforce good behavior.
So, using that phenomenon...
So we use that to our advantage, and we created a special therapy for internet gaming using virtual reality, or VR. We essentially forced the limbic system to engage by piping in the voice of a patient's mother, telling him to calm down, to stop playing their game, because their mother wants them to be happy.
Mother's voice... Please stop the play.
It strengthens the don't do it reflex we talked about earlier. And if the mother's voice doesn't work, there are other options.
I changed his own voice.
He has the patient's own voice piped into the headphones, and they ask themselves what will become of their futures if they keep playing.
You almost have them become their own conscience.
Yeah, right.
My voice in my head is literally the voice in your head.
Han says he's coupling the unconscious mind with the conscious one. He's essentially compelling them to control their compulsive behavior internally. He says he scanned their brains after the virtual reality therapy, and he found that their limbic systems, the ones that had switched off during excessive gaming, has switched back on, helping the kids restrain the impulse to game. Hospitals in the U.S. are still assessing the iguana system. It's unclear whether a mother's voice would have the same effect on kids in America. Without knowing what Dr. Han was testing in Korea, Felix Graham ended up stumbling on a very similar prescription to kick his internet gaming habit. He told himself over and over again that he was spending too much time gaming, and it was taking over his life, and he didn't like who he'd become.
I strive to be the best, and I put in hours that no one else would, and I was. But you always want more, because the only thing you need is that sense of accomplishment, but you never get that.
So, he decided to stop. just like that. And his mother and his brother Oscar both seem pretty proud of him for doing that.
Like when you stop playing, it kind of, it's quite peaceful, it's like mind fog is gone.
So what's the answer to the question now when you ask yourself, who am I?
I'm an avid squash player. I love badminton. I want to go do table tennis at an intermediate level. I very much like music. I like cold showers. Yeah, you know, that's one of the greatest things. I like learning. I really like French. I like to be out at least maybe once or twice every weekend. I like to do sports for 5 times a week. I definitely like exercise. I enjoy reading. I like learning about like modern era history, such as World War II and the Cold War. And I'm an avid fan of social politics.
Those are lots of interests. Wow. Okay. Is your list that long too, Oscar?
No, it's a little bit short.
In our next episode, we meet someone who was bullied and then finds friends in an unexpected place.
There was a surprising amount of support in a community that would be associated with an act of violence.
That's next time on What Were You Thinking? This episode of What Were You Thinking was reported by me, Dina Temple-Raston, and Caitlin Pierce, who also produced this episode. Our editor is Martha Little, sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ankrum. Korean interpretation and voiceover work by Sunjin Kim and Jeff Lee. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. This is Audible.
This episode contains emotional content that may not be appropriate for all audiences.
Do you remember the first time?
Sadly, yes. I don't remember the exact age, but I was in the second grade. And it was actually by my second grade teacher. And at one point pulled me in front of class and said, "You'll never amount to anything. Why are you trying?" And it just slowly began to build from there.
That's Dylan Cossey. And as he got older, the bullying moved to the cafeteria, where kids began throwing things.
Things, not just light things like food, but full-on milk cartons and apples were thrown at people's heads.
And then there was gym class.
"You know, you guys can't do anything until he finishes his laps in the gym. Come on, fatty, get moving." And everyone would start yelling and cursing at me. You know, if it was only one period during gym, okay, I can deal with that. But every period of the day, every time you walk out of your classroom, every time you go to your locker to get stuff and you have people making fun of you, there is no real escape.
Is it hard to talk about this?
It is to a degree. I still don't like to acknowledge how bad things were for me. I felt alone.
While there's been a lot of focus in the news on cyberbullying, experts will tell you that the kind of bullying Dylan experienced is much more common and has much more lasting effects. And in this case, it ended up changing Dylan's life.
And there was a knock on the door, around 10:30 at night. There were two officers and one detective standing there, and they asked, "Is Dylan Cossey here?" And I answered, "Yes, I'm him." And they asked us all to sit down. And that's when I believe it was the detective says they received a call that I was preparing to attack Plymouth White Marsh High School. And when they were starting to push me out the door, moving me to the squad car, I just yelled back, "I love you." And that was the last time I was home for a while.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston, and this is What Were You Thinking? A show about adolescent decisions, their developing brains, and how we can help them make better choices. We'll talk to experts about the increasing evidence that bullying can actually change the brain.
An individual who's under this kind of constant threat, there is going to be a strong amygdala component to that person's behavior.
And on very rare occasions, in combination with a lot of other factors, it can lead to tremendous violence.
The teacher says the gunman moved systematically through the school hallways, knocking on doors and shooting.
In this episode, bullying and its aftermath.
I did still feel like no one quite understood what had happened.
The first modern-day school shooting in this country happened in Texas in 1966.
A sniper identified as Charles J. Whitman started shooting from the observation deck. A terror-filled 90 minutes started at 5 minutes before 12 Austin time.
Charles Whitman had turned 25 just weeks before the shooting and was at the high end of the range brain experts consider adolescents, the ages of 13 to 24. It is a time when the brain is going through changes that scientists are only beginning to understand. Authorities found a journal in which Whitman laid out his descent into madness.
Lately, I cannot recall when it started, I've been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. I don't really understand myself these days. I'm supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man.
He was so startled by the way he was feeling that he suggested authorities do an autopsy after his death. He was convinced that there was something physically wrong with his brain.
His case is very complicated, right? Because it turned out that he had murdered his mother and wife, and then he went to campus and climbed the tower and continued his spree.
Ahmad Hariri is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, specializing in the amygdala.
On autopsy, they found this kind of dime-sized tumor in an area kind of almost at the very center of the brain. The coroner reported finding evidence of the tumor affecting the amygdala. That could have dramatically altered his perception of threat. That tumor impinging on his amygdala made him perceive familiar individuals, friends, as threat.
Think of the amygdala as the body's alarm system. It's a small, almond-shaped mass deep in the brain. The amygdala controls automatic responses to fear and negative emotions, and it's been linked to psychiatric disorders like anxiety and social phobias. We wondered whether someone who was constantly bullied, someone like Dylan, could see a change in their amygdala. Would they perceive threat differently?
I certainly think that an individual who is chronically bullied, who's under this kind of constant threat, there is going to be a strong amygdala component to that person's behavior. If we think about this in kind of an evolutionary framework, you want that. You want to learn about these dangers in the world, but fundamentally you want to translate that into avoidance. But in our modern society, we expect kids to go to school. And they can't just escape their bullies very easily. And so when you have this kind of chronic provocation and chronic kind of stress, then the expression of what is fundamentally designed as an adaptive response, an adaptive kind of function of the amygdala, becomes maladaptive.
Can you sort of walk us through a typical day?
I get to school early, trying to beat most of the kids there. I just go in, get what I need, and try to get through. It never gets any easier. Any person that I'm walking by could say something. At the end of the day, after everything is over, I just try to get to my locker as fast as I can. I grab what I need and I head outside, and I hope that someone to pick me up is waiting for me, because I don't want to have to stand there while everyone else walks by and unloads anything left over they have from the day. I was a relatively big and strong kid, and I felt like I should be able to handle this. I should be able to make them stop, but I can't. And I just have to sit here and take it. So I didn't want to talk to anyone about it, at least at home. Didn't want to tell family or friends about it, because I felt like this was weakness on my part.
Now, we should say here that school shootings are black swan events, and you can't begin to explain something that's extremely rare by pointing to something as common as bullying. Many things contribute to someone going on a rampage attack, and there's a big difference between fantasizing about one and actually launching one. Dylan Cossey says he never planned to attack a school.
There was never a plot with me, there was never a plan, but that didn't stop people from being scared.
Investigators are less sanguine. They say he did have a plan, but it wasn't imminent.
I don't know of any research that really helps us understand why or how an individual who's been bullied ultimately reaches a breaking point and decides to respond in a very exaggerated way. And it could be that there are changes in the amygdala which we don't understand yet.
Hariri has been measuring how the amygdala responds to threat in his lab at Duke. He shows research subjects pictures of angry and fearful faces, which they've learned represent bad things.
Bad things that are either going to happen to us in terms of anger, or bad things that may exist in the environment that we share with others. That's what we think fear is really communicating.
And what he's found is that the amygdala responds in really different ways, depending on the person. And what's even more surprising is that the brain remembers that amygdala response. It has a lasting effect.
If you take each individual's amygdala response to threat, you can actually predict the likelihood that they will experience depression and anxiety up to 4 years later. This was one of the first examples of being able to show that a single time point measure of brain function, in this case the amygdala's response, is a predictor.
Predictors are what everyone would love to have. Some red flag or sign that lets you know that someone is about to have a break. There is one thing experts agree is a red flag.
Well, I love history. And when I saw one day there was a documentary that was going to be coming on in a few weeks about the Columbine shooting. But I didn't know what that was. And when I saw the clips they were showing, it looked almost like a military operation. So I went online and just looked it up. And a surprising amount of the information that I found was actually posted by people supporting the shooters. A lot of it was independent people splicing together footage with music, making almost a music video to the documentary of the Columbine shooting, and putting up messages about this is why they did what they did. People in the chat room discussing, or in the comments section, I feel like them, I was made fun of too. It made me feel like, okay, there are other people out there who have been through what I've been through. I'm not the only one.
Dylan Cossey had found himself in a Columbine tribute site.
At first, I was just coming from a standpoint of curiosity. I wanted to know what happened, why it happened, where it happened. These are people like me. They've been made fun of. No one helped them. They feel alone and isolated. I'm not alone. There are other people out there who feel like me. And chances are, the shooters would have felt like me too. So I felt a sense of belonging, of community, in that online space.
Dylan said that community on the website was strangely nonviolent.
No one on there was openly discussing a shooting, talking about wanting to get a gun or commit an act of violence. Everyone on there, at least that I talked to, was just on there venting about how alone they felt, talking about what had happened to them that day or the day before, and getting sympathy from the other people who were there.
The conversations revolved around Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, the Columbine shooters.
Now, the tributes to the shooters would obviously show the news footage and pictures from the aftermath, which of course were horrific, but they would also show in personal life pictures of them, or home movies of them, and personalize them as people who were driven to that point, and would often come back to the point of, well, the Columbine shooters understood. They knew what you were going through. They were almost idolized by a lot of people for having taken action. That here's kids that went through what I went through and they did something about it.
Dr. Peter Langman is an expert on the psychology of school shooters and trains law enforcement on what to look for to spot them before they strike. He says you can't draw a straight line from bullying to school shootings.
Having looked at least 60 cases of school shooters, it's not nearly as significant an issue as people tend to think.
To understand school shooters, you have to bring together a combination of psychological, biological, and social forces. Nearly all the school shooters Langman has studied have a toxic mix of personality disorders, mental illness in their families, and some sort of trauma in their background.
These are kids that grow up amid violence and just chronic stress and trauma.
School shooters tend to have some physical deformity or body image issue.
Whether it's a birth defect, they're unusually short, maybe unusually overweight, unattractive, unathletic. For them, there's various challenges in terms of developing a healthy sense of their own masculinity.
And then there are social problems.
It could be, you know, academic failures. It could be disciplinary actions at school or getting arrested outside of school. It could be romantic rejections and breakups. Anything that feels like a rejection, a failure, a life setback. And when you put those on top of someone who is already psychopathic, psychotic, traumatized, maybe struggling with their own masculinity, and then you add these setbacks, it's a combination often of all these different factors that put someone on the path of violence.
In a way, school shootings are a violent conglomeration of a number of issues kids face between the ages of 13 to 24, from wanting to belong to assessing situations poorly to impulse control. But Langman says if young people can get through this period safely, most go on to lead perfectly normal adult lives.
If you catch someone in time during an adolescent crisis and give them the mental health support, the family support, whatever it is they need, you can maintain them safely through that crisis, and then they can go on to adulthood and be functioning members in society.
In previous episodes, we've focused on the adolescent brain's role in teenage empathy, intellectual curiosity, and even why they may assess situations so poorly. One thing we haven't addressed is hormones. Conventional wisdom had blamed hormones for teenage risky behavior, aggression, and violence. So I'd always thought that school shooters were an outgrowth of that. I assumed they were overwhelmingly adolescent and male because their testosterone levels were off the charts. But researchers will tell you it's much more complicated than that, and testosterone may be nothing more than an accomplice in this kind of behavior.
I'm Justin Kari. I'm a professor in the psychology department here at Nipissing University.
Nipissing University is about 3 hours north of Toronto. One of the experiments Kari did there was to test what happens to testosterone levels if you just watch a video of something aggressive and competitive. So, since he's in Canada, he had hockey players watch videos of their own performances on the ice. And guess what happened?
They show approximately a 40% rise in testosterone, which is quite substantial.
So if someone was watching, for example, videos of the Columbine shooting, would that have the same effect?
That's a really interesting question, and I hadn't thought of it that way in linking these two literatures, but I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that it might also produce these endocrine changes, like these, you know, a rise or a short-term rise in testosterone.
So here's what's surprising. It isn't just the level of testosterone that determines aggression. Personality plays a key role, too.
That single dose of testosterone within about 30 minutes to 45 minutes rapidly increases aggression in these impulsive guys. But guys who have more self-restraint, so guys who are not very impulsive, testosterone does nothing for aggressive behavior. So I think this really speaks to the idea that the hormone itself is having just a very weak effect.
Kari's subjects were undergrads and graduate students, so they were on the older side of the people we consider adolescents, young people from the ages of 13 to 24. His findings suggest that testosterone does promote aggression, but only for certain types of men. The ones who are vulnerable to the effects of testosterone are the ones who already describe themselves as dominant and impulsive. So imagine how testosterone would affect a young man who feels like he's been picked on for years and begins watching Columbine tribute videos. One of the people Dylan befriended on that Columbine page was a young man named Pekka Rick Alvinen. He was an 18-year-old Finnish kid.
He spoke English, and he had a lot in common with me.
And he had a couple of screen names. One was Natural Selection.
His other one, I believe, started with an S, and it was like Storm something, something like that. I wouldn't have said we were close friends, but we did talk probably a couple times a week on just instant messenger. And the majority of it was discussing different videos. He was one of the people that made videos for the shooters.
Pekka made tribute films, and many of them were about Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold.
He would often ask my opinion on them and, you know, give him any editing tips that I may have had. He would talk about how, you know, people would make fun of him and everyone would ignore what was happening, that he felt like there was no recourse, but at least the Columbine shooters got payback.
Striking up a friendship with Pekka, a young man who was also bullied halfway around the world, provided Dylan with some camaraderie.
All it did was serve to show me that this is not just isolated here in America. This is around the world that kids feel like there is no recourse for them, there is no justice for them, and idolizing those who got it, even if they didn't agree with their methods.
And did you get the sense that Pekka did agree with their methods?
Before I was arrested, I remember he put up a video that apparently he played some game called Hitman or whatever, and he acted out in the game a mass shooting and at the end had his character shoot himself. And I said, that's a little much, man. I wouldn't put that up. He told me that he was going to rethink it. I did ask him what was going on, but he just said, you know, it was just something I felt like recording that day.
Pekka Rick Alvinen grew up in Jokela, Finland, a small rural town about 45 minutes north of Helsinki.
Here we are. It's about an 8-minute walk from the station.
To get to Jokela, a commuter train speeds through rolling fields of hay and grain carved into piney forests. Little red and white cottages peek out from under the trees. Cows graze near the tracks.
Sorry, is this the high school?
Yes.
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, so I found it. Jokela High School. It's a 3-story building of brick and bright yellow stucco. It's quite lovely. And this is Finland's Columbine. This is where a handful of students and the headmaster lost their lives at the hands of one quite depressed and angry shooter.
Äiti, että miksi mulla ei ole yhtään kaveria?
Pekka's mother spoke to Finnish television and said during the school holidays he would ask her, why don't I have any friends? But Pekka did have one friend.
I'm Vaula. I live in Finland.
And we're talking today because...
Because of my friend who committed a school shooting in 2007.
And could you say his whole name for me? Because I'm never sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah, his full name is Pekka Erik Alvinen.
Vaula lives in an apartment just outside of Helsinki. She has a football-sized dog named Mickey.
I thought he never barked.
Mickey.
And she's very fond of unicorns. She has a unicorn purse. She's wearing unicorn earrings and several unicorn necklaces. And her screen name on the Finnish Facebook was...
Yksisarvi, which is unicorn in Finnish.
She knew Pekka by the screen name...
Stormgeist, which is German for storm spirit. We met online. It was on this webpage, which was pretty much like... kind of like what Facebook is now, except you didn't use your full name. You had this nickname. And pretty much every single Finnish teenager was there.
We're only using Vala's first name because of her association with Pekka.
He was very intelligent, and he had a lot of same interests as me. And just it was just easy talking to him.
Vala was 17 when she met Pekka. And she was in a typically angst-ridden, rebellious teenage phase.
My head was like, half of it was green and the other half was pink, and I had lots of piercings and whatnot.
Now she's 27 and blonde. She met Pekka in an online group called Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold.
Yeah, I remember Pekka mentioning how his middle name is also Eric, and he said that he finds it really ironic.
And did the subject of bullying ever come up?
He didn't really want to talk about it. I could tell that it was something that he had gone through, but he really didn't want to talk about it.
Their friendship was conducted entirely online.
When me and Beck became friends, we were both pretty severely depressed and had issues with sort of social situations. I know that Becca had, like, phobia of social interaction. And I know that, for example, Becca, it was really difficult to speak on the phone. And he would kind of have to kind of talk himself into talking on the phone. And he found something like that really difficult, which is also what I really struggle with.
Valna and Pekka would message back and forth for hours every evening. They talked a lot about Columbine.
He would talk about how he found Eric Harris and his thoughts very interesting, where I would really more associate with it.